Welcome back to the Journal Review. This month we're covering the June 2026 issue of Dermatologic Surgery, and I've pulled four pieces worth your attention: a practice commentary on car window tinting and UV exposure, a randomized split scar trial comparing two absorbable sutures for facial closures, a review of where regenerative aesthetics actually stands right now, and a short technique piece on tracking tumor across Mohs sections when you're dealing with dropout. Let's get into it. First up is a commentary style piece, essentially a clinical practice review, titled Clarifying UV Protection in Automobiles: Why Medical Tint Exemptions Are Unnecessary. You've all had this conversation: a patient with melasma, or a transplant patient, or just a sun-avoidant person with a stack of actinic keratoses asking you to write a letter supporting a darker window tint exemption. This piece is basically arming you with the physics and the counseling framework to redirect that conversation. The background here is straightforward. Chronic UV exposure through car windows produces that classic asymmetric driver-side predominant photo damage you see clinically, and patients reasonably want to do something about it. The authors walk through the solar spectrum. Ultraviolet, visible light, and infrared are physically distinct and can be filtered independently. The key clinical point is that windshields, being laminated glass, already block the vast majority of UVA, on the order of 96% on average. Side and rear windows are the problem. They're tempered glass, and they only block UVA by something like 70% on average, with a wide range depending on the vehicle. So the face and the arm resting on the door are getting real cumulative exposure over years of driving. Here's the part that should change how you counsel patients. The authors pulled manufacturer specifications from commercially available window films, comparing clear versus tinted products across a wide range of visible light transmittance, from very light to very dark. Every single product, regardless of how dark it was, claimed greater than 99% UV blockage. There was essentially zero correlation between how dark a tint is and how much UV it blocks. A statistically clean null finding, but more importantly, a clinically actionable one. Darkness is doing nothing for UV protection beyond a certain baseline. It's the presence of UV-absorbing additives that matters, not the dye load. In fact, clear films specifically engineered for UV blocking can hit that same 99%+ while maintaining 80 to 90% visible light transmittance, meaning they look like ordinary glass and stay fully compliant with state visibility statutes, which generally require a minimum of 70% visible light transmittance through windshields and front side windows. The practical framework the authors propose is worth adopting wholesale. Tell patients that effective UV protection does not require dark tinting, that clear UV blocking films exist and can be installed on side windows without any exemption paperwork, and that windshields typically don't need intervention at all, since they're already doing the job. Reinforce this with driving gloves, arm sleeves, and broad-spectrum sunscreen for the exposed side. And if a patient's real complaint is glare or photophobia, rather than a cutaneous photosensitivity disorder, sunglasses are the more appropriate fix, not a tint exemption. There's no methods or results section here, in the traditional sense. This is a synthesis and counseling tool, but the practical takeaway is genuinely practice-changing for how you handle these exemption requests. You can now tell patients with data in hand that a legally compliant clear film outperforms their dark tint request on the metric that actually matters. Next, a full original study, a blinded, randomized, split-scar clinical trial titled Photographic Assessment of Cosmetic Outcome in Post-Surgical Facial Scars favors rapidly absorbable polyglactin 910 over fast-absorbing GUT. This comes out of the University of British Columbia group, senior authored by David Zlotti, who previously ran the largest trial comparing rapidly absorbable polyglactin, brand name Vicryl Rapid, against nylon for epidermal closure, and found equivalent cosmesis. This new trial fills a real gap. Nobody had rigorously compared two different absorbable suture types against each other for epidermal closure. The design is a split-scar trial in 105 patients undergoing Mohs closures of at least 4 centimeters on the face. Each wound got rapidly absorbable polyglactin on one half and fast-absorbing GUT on the other, randomized, with identical buried polyglactin sutures underneath to handle tension in both halves. So the only variable being tested is the epidermal suture material itself. This split wound design is the smart methodological choice here, and it's explicit in the paper. Using each patient as their own control eliminates the huge between-patient variability in healing and scar formation that would otherwise require a much larger sample to detect a modest suture-level difference. At 6 months, two physicians who were not involved in the surgery, a dermatologist and a plastic surgeon, rated each half of every healed scar on photographs, blinded to which suture had been used, using three validated instruments, the visual analog scale, the Stony Brook scar evaluation scale, and the wound evaluation scale. The results? The blinded dermatologist ratings favored rapidly absorbable polyglactin across all three scales, and this reached statistical significance most robustly on the Stony Brook scale. The blinded plastic surgeon's ratings also trended in favor of the polyglactin on every scale, but didn't cross the threshold for significance. What makes this more convincing than it might sound is that across two independent reviewers, three different scales, and the split scar design, that's 12 total comparisons, and every single one pointed the same direction, toward polyglactin, a pattern the authors calculate would be extremely unlikely to occur by chance alone if there were truly no difference between the sutures. There was no difference in infection or dehiscence between sides. A small rate of tissue necrosis, split evenly between suture types, and a modestly higher rate of epidermolysis on the gut side, though this didn't translate into a difference in final scar quality at 6 months. The author's own proposed mechanism is that fast-absorbing gut degrades enzymatically, which alters local pH and generates a more inflammatory milieu, whereas rapidly absorbable polyglactin degrades hydrolytically into simple glycolic and lactic acid, theoretically a gentler process that could translate into less erythema and more orderly collagen remodeling. They're upfront about the limitations: single institution, facial wounds only, an elderly and predominantly lighter Fitzpatrick population, so generalizability to younger patients, other body sites, or darker skin types is unknown. 6 month assessment may also underrepresent erythema. And the discrepancy between the two blinded reviewers, significant for the dermatologist, not for the plastic surgeon, is acknowledged as unresolved. The authors speculate the specialties may simply weight different scar features, but this is honestly a soft spot in interpreting the strength of the effect. Practically, is this practice changing? I'd call it a meaningful data point, but not a mandate to rip out gut suture from your kit. The magnitude of the cosmetic difference is real but modest. Nobody is describing dramatically inferior scars with gut. Where this probably does move the needle is cost and consistency. Rapidly absorbable polyglactin is roughly 20% cheaper than fast-absorbing gut on comparable needles. Degrades in a similar or even slightly longer but still patient-friendly time frame, and now has trial-level evidence, however modest, of a cosmetic edge. If you've been agnostic between the two for facial epidermal closure, this gives you a reasonable basis to default to polyglactin. Third, a review article. Regenerative Aesthetics, Present Advances and Emerging Strategies for Optimized Tissue Health. This is a structured literature review built around a Prisma-guided search that ultimately included 74 articles, organized around what the authors call the three pillars of regenerative aesthetics: cellular treatments, biochemical cues, and scaffolds. On the cellular side, the review walks through adipose-derived stem cells, stromal vascular fraction, and nanofat. Adipose-derived stem cells work largely through paracrine secretion of growth factors and cytokines, and clinical evidence, mostly small studies, graded B to D quality in the author's own grading scheme, supports use in accelerating recovery after ablative laser, treating acne scarring, and general facial rejuvenation. Stromal vascular fraction, obtained by collagenase digestion of fat, is mainly used as an adjunct to fat grafting, since autologous fat transfer has notoriously variable retention. The review cites resorption rates anywhere from a quarter to as much as 4/5 of the transferred volume, largely from central graft ischemia. SVF enrichment is used to improve graft survival in facelift and breast augmentation contexts, and there's a randomized trial showing improved scar appearance when SVF is injected into fresh surgical incisions. That one's graded as their highest quality evidence tier. A newer variant, hybrid SVF, preserves extracellular matrix components like collagen and elastin during processing, while still achieving comparable cell yields to standard enzymatic digestion, theoretically adding regenerative potential beyond cell count alone. Nanofat is presented as an appealing alternative precisely because it's mechanically emulsified rather than enzymatically digested, which sidesteps the more stringent regulatory classification that enzymatic SVF processing falls under in many jurisdictions. The review flags this as a genuine practical advantage, not just a technical curiosity, since it can be harvested, processed, and re-injected in one session under a lighter regulatory burden. Beyond stem cells, the review covers exosomes as a biochemical cue modality with reported utility in wound healing, pigmentary disorders, and skin rejuvenation. Polydeoxyribonucleotides and polynucleotides, which show tissue repair and anti-inflammatory effects, and notably, can also function as physical scaffolds for volumization. And an interesting update on poly-L-lactic acid, where newer data suggest its volumizing effect isn't purely a mechanical scaffold phenomenon. It may also be actively stimulating adipose-derived stem cells and remodeling the extracellular matrix, which is a more mechanistically sophisticated explanation than the traditional collagen stimulator framing. As a review, there's no results versus limitations arc in the traditional sense, but the authors are candid about where the field stands. Regulatory standardization is lagging the science, particularly around what counts as minimal manipulation for cell-based therapies, and protocols for isolation and processing remain inconsistent across studies, which makes cross-study comparison difficult. The practical takeaway for a Mohs and oncologic dermatology practice is mostly interesting, not yet actionable. This is squarely adjacent to reconstructive and cosmetic practice, rather than oncologic surgery itself. But it's directly relevant if you're doing scar optimization or fat grafting adjuncts in your reconstructive work. And the SVF into fresh incision data for scar improvement is the one piece here with the most direct crossover potential into post-Mohs reconstructive care, assuming access and regulatory pathways in your jurisdiction allow it. Last, a short technique communication. Zeroed in, improving histologic tumor tracking during Mohs micrographic surgery. This is a practical pearl, not a study, so there's no methods versus results architecture. Just a problem, a technique, and a takeaway. The problem is one every Mohs surgeon knows intimately. Tissue dropout and minimal residual tumor near the true margin make section-to-section tracking genuinely difficult, and interpretive error is a documented contributor to recurrence. The authors cite prior work showing tissue dropout alone carries roughly an 8-fold increased recurrence risk compared to cases without dropout, and separately, a pilot study showing that using actual histologic sections as Mohs maps rather than schematic hand drawings improves mapping accuracy. That's the conceptual seed for this technique. The technique itself, working from the more superficial section where residual tumor is clearly identified, the surgeon outlines that tumor area directly on the slide under the microscope with a marking pen. Then, the deeper sections, moving toward the true margin, are physically superimposed and aligned with that marked slide. And the outline is traced onto each successively deeper section. This lets the surgeon zero in precisely on the corresponding location at the true margin and make a confident call about whether tumor is actually present there or whether it's simply obscured by dropout or thin tissue. The authors pair this with a broader practice point. Rather than aggressively facing tissue blocks to force a complete section containing epidermis, dermis, and subcutis, which can inadvertently shave into and expose more superficial residual tumor, creating a false positive margin call, they process all sections as cut, even incomplete ones, preserving full histologic context, and then use the overlay and trace technique to correlate a tumor-positive superficial area with a deeper, possibly incomplete, but tumor-free true margin. There's no outcomes data attached to this. It's presented as a practical safeguard layered on top of standard mapping, which the authors note already achieves cure rates approaching 99% for non-melanoma skin cancers. So the honest framing is that this is a technique pearl grounded in sound reasoning about tissue architecture and interpretive pitfalls, not a validated intervention with its own recurrence data. The practical takeaway is straightforward and low cost to adopt. Next time you hit dropout near a call you're not fully confident in, mark the tumor boundary on the more superficial slide and physically overlay it onto the deeper sections before committing to a positive or negative margin call. It costs you nothing beyond a marking pen and a few extra seconds under the scope. And it directly targets the exact failure mode, dropout-associated interpretive error, that the literature identifies as a real driver of recurrence. That wraps this month's review. To summarize where the actionable value sits, the window tint piece gives you an immediately usable counseling script that changes how you handle exemption requests. The suture trial offers a modest but statistically consistent edge for rapidly absorbable polyglactin over fast-absorbing gut and facial epidermal closure, reasonable to adopt as a default given the added cost advantage. The Regenerative Aesthetics Review is valuable background, but stays largely in the watch this space category, outside of scar-specific SVF applications. And the Mohs tracking technique is a zero-cost pearl worth incorporating into your own slide reading routine today. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next month.